Stories of Power. Transcription poems by Alan Sutherland from the words of Jess Tom. But first, a word from the ticks. I love beans. Hello, cat. Trigonometry killed the radio star, but it didn't kill mother's kitten. Beans. Fuck it. I love cats. Fuck it. I hate cats. Biscuit. Hedgehog. Biscuit it. Primary. I struggled in my first primary school because I moved around a lot, fell over a lot relatively. I was relatively disruptive in lots of ways, but not intentionally. As a neurodiverse child in the 80s, I've got some very early memories of failing as well, teachers talking about me. I think certainly my school life, up until the age of 9 or 10, was mainly characterised by a feeling of failure. One of the other very strong memories I have is being taken by school to the Tate Gallery when I was about 6 or 7, going up a spiral staircase and sitting in a studio in a big circle with my classmates, and a man in the middle introducing himself as an artist. And it blew me away, because I didn't know that artists were alive people. I didn't know it was an actual job you could do. And I think from that point on, I knew that that was gonna be the job that I did. Creativity has always been an integral part of my life. Partly because I was encouraged to draw instead of doing anything more substantial for the first years of my primary education. Shame. I had tics since I was a child, but they were much less noticeable to other people then. My parents were very accepting of me and my range of very unusual chaotic behaviour, and I felt very accepted exactly as I am. But I did feel that there were aspects of my being I didn't understand and didn't feel like I had space to talk about. That is something that I say to parents. Just because a child looks like they're managing or their tics aren't that noticeable, they will know, and to a certain extent, not talking about the tics can make people feel that they're embarrassing or that there's shame. And that process of shame as a disabled child, young person, adult, that process of shame starts really early. Finding out. I was a disabled child. I received specialist education. I had a number of different diagnoses that didn't lead to Tourette's, definitely understood in the context of neurodiversity. And I remember when I was at my first primary school, which means that I would have been under 8, looking for information around the things that I was experiencing in the children's library. I remember bringing home a book called Mentally Handicapped. It was Such and Such is Mentally Handicapped. It was a book for children, and using that language and talking to my mum, is this me? So I was looking for that as a child. What I didn't get was any good answers or good representation. That's not necessarily the fault of my family, because I think there was a lot of openness and discussion. You know, I had lots of things explained to me really well, but it was around what was wrong with me, rather than anything about the sort of barriers that I would encounter in the world. Lots of parents, when they first receive diagnoses, what they worry about is the future. And for me, when parents say they're worrying about the future, they're worrying about their children leading full active lives and being able to participate within their communities. Obviously, it's different for different conditions, but I think there's an element where I'm curious. if we change those first moments, if we change the way children and families receive diagnosis, we can tweak some of those early encounters, including making sure parents understand the social model, potentially including parents understanding their role as advocates, and being given skills and resources to do that, and being honest about the challenges which they face. I wonder if there is a welcome rather than a sorrow around diagnosis, or a sort of, here you go and get on with it. I feel like we could drastically change the outcomes for the children who will then go on to be disabled adults and then become the next generation of disabled makers and creators. My sister. I have one sister who I'm really, really close to, and she's a doctor. She's 5 years younger than me and was on the receiving end of a lot of unusual behaviour as a child. I realised a few years ago that she's the only other person in the whole world for whom my tics have always been part of their life, whereas other people have to get to know them, or get to know my body, or get to know how my mind works. And so she has an acceptance and a response to that that is so deep and supportive that it almost defies description. That sort of unconditional acceptance of the reality of the situation, and that being a fact, the fact about me and my body, amongst many other facts, and is interesting, because in lots of other areas of my life, it's something that people have to learn to be with, to cope with, whatever language you want to use. And certainly, you know, my parents are very supportive of me. I think they really struggled at various times to know how to help me grow into an independent and happy person. They've done it, but I don't think that's a straightforward journey for anybody raising a child who is neurodiverse and likely to encounter barriers that are invisible to other people. I think some of the physical barriers I encounter are really easy to explain to people. And I think people can understand some of the attitudinal barriers. But the experience of constantly being problematized is hard. Special school. I left my first primary school when I was 8 or 9 and did 2 years in a specialist setting for young people with specific learning disabilities. It was a setting that was designed to take young people who were struggling at school and work with them intensively to a point where they would be able to go back into a mainstream system. And so I had lots of input there, but the most important thing I think that they did was rebuild my confidence. I don't think it would have ever occurred to me in lots of ways to go in a performance direction. I think that's an amazing opportunity that educators have in terms of recognising talent and nurturing it and helping people feel confident about aspects of themselves, particularly if you are used to being talked about in terms of deficit and in terms of problems. I definitely started to feel like a problem and had been made to feel like a problem in school lots of the time. They experimented quite a lot at that school, and a couple of classes were given computers. They were taught how to touch type. Using a sort of specialist program, were able to use computing and computers in their lessons. I was not part of that group. I was part of a group of children that got to walk around the hall with a hula hoop round their middle, trying not to bump into each other. My grandparents. I had a very close relationship with my maternal grandparents. I lived on and off with them at various points. And it was my gran persevered in terms of my education. I think she was probably the only one, only person who ever managed to properly teach me anything, as in a sort of one person teaching another person directly something. And she did that by a combination of bribery and repetition. My granddad was quite an obsessive. I'm sure that there's an element of Tourette's that links to that obsessive-compulsive behaviour. And there's definitely, you can trace that back in the family. One of the things that me and my granddad used to do together in an evening was walk around locally and identify broken lampposts and take down their serial numbers. And then once a week he'd go and report them all to the council. And we'd have to stand in line while he did his weekly report. And he'd get very frustrated if the same lamppost continued to be out of action. But that's funny now to me. That was a lovely, like, I really enjoyed those walks. I'm now reflecting back on that. That's not a natural activity. There aren't rambling associations that do that as part of their roots. When I moved into this place, there's a lamppost that I can see from my bedroom window that my tics have a very strange relationship with. So I brush my teeth, get into my pyjamas, get into bed, and then go on to the lamppost about the brightness of the moon and talk to a TV aerial. I think one of the things that I've really come to appreciate, and actually writing every day as part of the blog, the Tourette's Hero blog, helped me get to this point, was really valuing the relationship that Tourette's gives me to the world around me. I notice details, or my tics notice details, that the conscious part of me wouldn't, and then draw my attention to them, and everybody else's attention to them, in often very funny ways. The Fortunate Geranium. My friend Matthew got given a geranium. And the moment it appeared in his house, I started swearing at it and sticking my finger up at it, essentially bullying the geranium. But I'm sure that plant would not have survived and would not have been kept alive had it not had that impact on my tics. So I feel like I might have been being quite mean to the geranium, but I feel like it owes me its life, because there's no way Matthew would have looked after that plant and kept it alive if I hadn't been regularly shouting at it, and he found that funny. I noticed the themes, like Tourette's will often notice the seasons before I do and will start chatting to the tree or to the sky. Secondary. I didn't have a diagnosis of Tourette's in secondary school. I had a diagnosis of other conditions. But I was lucky in that my behaviour was, I think, always understood in the context of neurodiversity. I went through a phase at secondary school of running uncontrollably into closed doors, which was probably quite a large thing for teachers to manage. But they did. And I was never told off for that. I talk to teachers. I often talk about an experience where my whole year group was in the gymnasium and we'd all got basketballs in front of us. A male PE teacher was standing at the front and told us not to touch the balls, the basketballs. And I just picked the one up in front of me and hurled it at him, and it hit him square in the face. He ordered me out of the gym in a rage, and the humiliation that was written over him, and the fear and the terror that was in me of having done something I definitely didn't feel like I had chosen to do. It had totally shocked me in terms of what had happened. He ordered me out of the gym, and he came to speak to me, and he asked me why I'd done it. And I said I didn't know, and said I hadn't chosen to do it, and it had just happened. And he believed me, and he understood me. And he did not punish me, and he did not go on about it. and I now feel that that would have taken an incredible amount of strength. If you're humiliated by a child, it's very easy for teachers to react on a very impersonal level, but he didn't. I was sent on errands all the time. It had not occurred to me that I was being given carefully structured movement breaks. So there's certain things now that I know were there. I was being looked out for. Remember, remember. I was in all the bottom sets, and I didn't find school easy from an academic point of view. But then, about 6 weeks before my GCSEs, I don't know where or when, but I suddenly realised that the teachers basically knew what was going to be in the exam papers, or had a fairly good idea, that we just needed to remember it. And I was furious. Why did nobody tell me that all I needed to do was remember it, like remember stuff? Because I knew that I could make myself remember it, just couldn't do it in a way that they were trying to teach me. I was trying to know this stuff. I didn't need to know it. I just need to remember it. So I created myself loads of big posters, colourful posters with all the key information, and I put them around the house. And every time I walked past them or used the toilet, I would make myself read them from start to finish. That was utilising that obsessive part of my brain to acquire information. It's exactly the same strategy that I use now when I'm learning lines. The reason that I can do Samuel Beckett's Not I is because of that exact same process that I worked out when I was 15. I then did much better in my GCSE exams than anyone was expecting. Camberwell. I didn't go to agricultural college as planned at 16 and do a land-based industries course. Instead, I stayed on and suddenly got art in a way that, like suddenly got that I could make art in a way that I wanted. And I think that that it wasn't about being good at doing a specific thing. It was just about that I needed to let myself be creative and that would work. And so that was exciting. And then I applied for art college. I went and did a foundation course at Camberwell College of Art, and then stayed on, did a BA in drawing. And I was lucky that the course I did took a very broad view of what drawing was and understood it as a process of creative thinking. And I think that that sort of thinking creatively and the process of trying, testing stuff out and solving problems, definitely had been enhanced by my experiences as a disabled person. As disabled people, we are very good at adapting. It means that we can find amazing solutions to problems and barriers. I started to understand that we have to make the right adjustments, and it can be very easy to adapt to inequality rather than make some of the adjustments necessary to equalise opportunity. Particularly on public transport. Particularly on public transport, I have had loads of amazing conversations, but also really difficult experiences. My right to be in public space as someone who behaves in an unusual way is often something people have opinions on. When I was a child, people had opinions on whether I should be in the classroom or whether I should be in a mainstream setting. As a young adult travelling by public transport, as I wanted to go to art galleries or theatres, people had opinions on whether I should be on the bus or not. And I think I had been inadvertently taught by the system of how we like to educate and raise young people as a community. I had been taught that other people's rights trumped my own, and that there were certain places that weren't for me because I couldn't behave in a way that was appropriate for those contexts. It didn't occur to me as a child to question that, or as a young person to question those contexts. That's why it's important to do that now. Playwork. Working with children and young people has always been an absolutely integral part of what I want to be doing as a creative person. Some of that is because playing is fun, and it's exciting to make things happen. And kids are really full of imagination and joy and go with the process in an exciting way. Part of that is because I believe that those positive experiences are protective, and that they give children and young people stuff to draw on and feel proud of when things are inevitably tough, when they hit barriers. So inclusive play and working on adventure playgrounds for disabled and non-disabled children is where I think I learned to be a performer. I certainly didn't go to drama school. Charlie Chaplin Playground. All the time of my creative education, I was also working as a play worker in an adventure playground for disabled and non-disabled children in Camberwell. I needed to earn some money. I needed a summer or weekend job. I'd grown up on adventure playgrounds as a child and was going past one that looked good and actually saw an advert for jobs there in the big issue, and so applied and started working there. That was actually a place called Charlie Chaplin Adventure Playground. Matthew and I have a big relationship with that, and it's where we met. It's where we started putting on participatory events for the children there. Something out of nothing. We decanted the whole of Charlie Chaplin, 80 kids, to the South London Gallery. They'd given us the space, the main space, when they had a gap in their programme. The idea was to do an event without outcomes, where we had no expectation of what the outcome would be. It was not directly funded by anyone, so it meant that we weren't worrying about it having to do anything. It was an experiment. We created a space where there were costume-making practitioners, musicians, live musicians, digital artists who had computers and projectors set up, and DJs and painters and collage artists. And there was an accessible ramp, catwalk-style platform ramp, that went down the middle of the gallery that was fully accessible. Every child, when they arrived, was given, and every adult, everybody, in fact, all the staff working in the gallery that day, every single person was given a white paper dust suit. And the invitation is that this is your starting point. You can use any of the resources or any of the things here to create whatever, to make something out of this nothing. And our hunch was that the imaginations and energy of the children, we could trust in that. We didn't need to do anything else. It was an absolutely brilliant event, and it ended in a parade along this ramp of all of these costumes. And that was definitely one of the first events that Matthew and I had really created and designed in a cultural space rather than in a playground. It did some good stuff, both within that institution and in terms of the opportunities for young people we were working with. So we just started doing that more and more. Sow Gardens. I'm a play worker and an artist, and I did a residency for the South London Gallery in a barber's shop on the Sow Gardens estate. I worked with the children and young people on the estate to map and research and investigate their play through a load of creative things, and we turned the barber's shop into a sort of three-dimensional map of their play on their estate. And also it was a centre for playful responses to the world around them. And then that was also a challenging time, because shortly after that residency, there was a big fire on that estate, and lots of the children witnessed that. It was quite a difficult, traumatic time for the whole community. And two of the children who'd been involved with that project died in that fire, which was the Lackenal House fire. I had that relationship with lots of the families, and was a play worker, and recognised that in those traumatic spaces, the needs of children are often missed. Not deliberately missed, but not given attention where people are trying to cope with losing their homes and their possessions and finding housing, and the distress of that, the trauma of that. Doing play work in the middle of that felt important. Catching the Moon. Matthew often talks about a beautiful moment at the South London Gallery when one of the technicians was repositioning a spotlight. And the children noticed that and started following it and trying to reach for it and jump for it. And then this game emerged between the technician and the children, where he was moving the light around and they were jumping around and reaching for it. It was like a sort of amazing trying to catch the moon. Nobody had planned that. Nobody had defined that, designed that. It's about understanding that you just go with the flow. And then within Tourette's Hero, going with ticks. And they were some of the first creative experiments we did, where, rather than have a conversation like this, where we largely ignore the ticks, instead we went with them and let their unusual stories unfold. Within our practice now, some of what we do that I feel most excited by is where we use tics like my neurology to generate involuntary text. And partly why I think I relate to the not I text is part of my progress as an artist and as a human being was understanding that Tourette's was part of me and was coming from my brain and my tics. Before that, I would always talk about them as the tics, the Tourette's. And lots of like accepting how you live with a voice that you don't have control of, and words that aren't communicative straightforwardly, is a really challenging place to negotiate, particularly as an adult, because of the variety of responses and judgments that that then comes with. And the lack of anonymity, and the standing out in public space, and, you know, I'd often feel like talking about Tourette's and talking about my impairment and talking about disability isn't always a choice. It's a tool for living. And in a way, being a performer and doing that on stage or doing that in public speaking, it's just you hit more people at the same time. I value conversation deeply. But I also recognise that talking about Tourette's has changed my life in terms of having the confidence to do that and explain what I need and ask for help when I need it and understand that that independence isn't about doing everything for yourself but about being in control of the decisions. Becoming disabled. My tics had been intensifying from my early 20s. By 2006, they were enough of an issue for me to have sought diagnosis. I knew I had Tourette's long before that, and that is probably the point where I was. They were having significant impact on my life and my visibility in public space, and I'd come across things like BBC Ouch. I feel a great sadness that we've lost out as a disabled led platform the way that it used to exist, because it allowed me, from the safety of my home, to read and access the voices of disabled people with a range of different experience and impairments, to engage with disability culture in a playful, funny, really accessible way. It meant that I could build my identity as a disabled person quietly, and then get to a point where I was able to articulate and express that with the language of disability, rooted in the language of disability activism. And that's also why I think online space is really crucial. I don't think it's the only way, because I think also, for example, it was through BBC Ouch that I found Liberty Festival. Liberty Festival. At that point, I had been increasingly restricting my life. From my late teens, not staying very long in places, constantly having to manage the impact of my impairment without feeling like I could share that with anyone. Well, you know, I did talk about it. I certainly found it very difficult to talk about. It was an upsetting part of my life. Rather than now, it feels like a very positive part of my identity. It was through Liberty Festival that I saw people on stage and saw the depth and richness of the disability arts scene and started to be introduced to disabled artists, who then shaped my expectations of myself. Seeing, you know, Matt Fraser and Liz Carr at Liberty Festival, watching Catherine Araniello, the disabled avant-garde videos, I found it very hard to find experiences of Tourette's and disability reflected. Part of the reason we started Tourette's Hero was because there wasn't anything that reflected the humour and surrealness. Keeping it global, I started to understand that we have to make the right adjustments as individuals and as a community. And it can be very easy to adapt to inequality rather than make some of the adjustments necessary to equalise opportunity. Because I have had an opportunity to travel internationally, I understand, I've got the chance to understand and see how the expectations of disabled people are so very much shaped by the politics of where they live, the politics of the place or systems. Crip time was talked about in Canada, for example. It's the way that some activists and academics talk about disabled people's experience of time, the assumptions that they made about the control people had over their lives. Hearing people talk about the way that they crowdsource their care and manage that. I'm really keen to keep trying to have a global and international perspective on our conversations, because otherwise we can't see the barriers that are just part of the system that we're living in. It's really easy to miss the barriers when you're being restricted by them. But often on our side, I will be like, you don't need different time. You just need accessible public transport. And obviously, some of that is simplistic. But I do think the politics of place and continuing to find way to have conversations across borders feels essential, crucial, now more than ever. Abuse. I'm used to having all sorts of weird experiences on buses and public transport. I had so many. Whether that's laughing, whether that's nice conversations, curious conversations, aggressive responses. I've had all of that in response to my tics. But what happened at the start of last year was so different, and it was based on me being a wheelchair user rather than my tics. And straightforwardly, it was 10 minutes of the most personal abuse that I've ever experienced. Targeted abuse. And abuse that They were really wanting to make sure that I knew that the horrible things that they were saying were directed at me, and were directed at me because I use a wheelchair. Nobody else on the bus did anything, and the most upsetting part of that was the silence afterwards, rather than the horrible things that were said to me. My instinct was to minimise it, was to like, to feel like, to not say anything, to rationalise why that happened. I didn't stop the bus, didn't tell the bus driver, didn't ask my PA to ask the bus driver, didn't do anything to take action about it, other than make some notes about what was being said to me and where. That sort of the natural instinct to just explain things away was so present, and it was only with the support of friends. It was like, this does need to. I do need to talk to the police about this. I do need to go through all these steps. But I also wrote about it and had a creative network to draw on, had a way of making that experience visible to other people and processing it. Blog. I did feel like the humour and weirdness of my experiences weren't being reflected. And so I started writing. We tried Tourette's Hero. We started talking about it as a website. The main goal was to share tics for other people to make art in response to. And we had a go with hundreds of images and poems. And you know these lists of musicians who responded and filmmakers, so that was the intent. And so Matthew's saying to me, you should start practicing writing. You should start writing a blog to give the context of lots of the stuff that we're doing, to give the wry humour and to make sure that people understand about sitting in the right place. I had, obviously, had a relationship with writing that was not always good, but it became an incredibly important part of my life. And particularly important because it helped. I think before that I would have always drawn from the negative experiences. I'd be able to talk about the times people had hurt me and discriminated against me, and the challenges of that, they were all instantly available to me. What writing every day helped me realise was all the spontaneous support in conversations, beautiful moments as well as the challenging bits, and I was able to see them in a new way. And difficult experiences, I would be thinking, well, I'm going to be able to write about this, and how am I going to do that? And again, it gave me opportunities to reframe those and feel strong at points where things were hard. Independent living. In 2011, I started experiencing increasing episodes, tics that affected my ability, tics that affected, that meant I would suddenly lose complete control of my body and speech. I had a support worker 2 days a week, and I had no social care, and I was living in a flat up 6 flights of stairs with no lift, and with deteriorating ability. I felt very trapped. Then I was supported to apply for access to work. My employer was brilliant, and I got to experience being managed by a quiet, strong female manager, very supportive and gentle. I learned a lot from her. And access to work and the inclusive environment at Oasis allowed me to keep working and doing the job that I loved at a point where that felt impossible. I didn't think that was possible at the beginning, but I was supported to see that that could happen. For a long time, I was much more independent at work than I was at home. Couldn't take any leave because I had access to work supporting me at work. But at home, I was put upstairs by a support worker on the Friday night, and then had to stay there until somebody came to take me down on a Monday, unless friends or family came and got involved. So I think then, suddenly realising that it was time to think about accessing support. It's really hard to know at what point to make those decisions and how to do that. I was very lucky in that I'd worked in those professional settings. But still, doing that for myself was very... I didn't know how to do that. Lots of those systems are really invisible to people, and invisible to people who need them. And I don't see that that's going to change from a structural level. So I think with disabled people as communities, we need to share the knowledge about those systems, and to keep doing that and challenging that, and doing that in as broad a way as possible to try and catch some of those people. There is a large amount of institutional discrimination that is not acknowledged about who accesses what and how. I certainly think that there are some local authorities who, certainly in recent years, basically divide up support not on needs, but on the risk of people taking legal action, how able someone is to assert their rights to certain services. And that's not on. The era of the first 2 years of the cuts as a disabled person was very unsettling, watching equalities being rolled backwards. Making connection. You know, I was taught publicly over and over again about this sort of moment where I felt a real change in my own attitude to my body. And it was in a conversation with the co-founder of Tourette's Hero, Matthew. We've worked in playgrounds together since 2000. We'd had lots of conversations in that time about my changing tics and the impact of that on my work. And I'd always, up until that point, got upset, and I couldn't talk about Tourette's or any of my experiences relating to them without tears. We'd have lots of conversations about creativity in relation to that, but I heard this conversation differently. And the key part of that was that he described Tourette's as a crazy language-generating machine, and told me that not doing something creative with it would be wasteful. And it was the combination of those two things. It's the combination of imagining it as a machine, as a sort of fascinating producer of new ideas and language, and churning out words, that I was really drawn to. I was able to understand that maybe that access to that spontaneous creativity that Tourette's gives me has value. And didn't just have value for me within my own practice, but potentially I could record the things that I said and gift them to other people to be used as sort of springboards for their own creativity. And that was the birth of Tourette's Hero. But also the first time where I was able to really connect Tourette's to my professional understanding around disability and play. Actually bring it into my own life and live it, rather than just feel on the side of it. Does that make sense? Memories are made like this. One of the ideas that underpins Tourette's Hero is the idea that positive memories are protective, that if we give disabled people, particularly disabled children, positive experiences in public space, then they have something to draw on when they inevitably hit barriers. Words like resilience have been politicised and used by the Covenant government and the some of those things are about putting it back on communities to manage without the right support. But actually, there is also, I think, a really important role of making sure people have the tools to withstand the barriers and keep going. Because that is hard. Positive experiences are key for me. Being able to feel connected to a network of other disabled artists. Having the tools, skills, resources to communicate my experiences has meant that I've been able to process and manage changes or challenges that would have, at other points in my life, really floored me. Working with Tourette's. We were recently discussing our aims as an organisation, and absolutely everything we do goes beyond Tourette's as a specific impairment. I totally subscribe to the view that disabled people don't need to talk about their impairments, and people don't have a right to know about my impairment. However, one of the interesting things about Tourette's and how we've chosen to work with it is it feels so intrinsic to my practice, and that collaborating with that part of my neurology and makeup and using the things that are the product that essentially would be described in a medical context as symptoms of a condition, as springboards for creativity and catalysts for making art, means that I feel like I'm acknowledging my impairment in a particular way that isn't about educating others, and is much more about using the creative force that's within me. Stories of power. Our first event as Tourette's Hero was in December 2010 and was on the snowiest day of the year. We had 300 children invited from all over the UK, with and without Tourette's, to a secret superhero lair. We'd made a video that was about Tourette's Hero doing an emergency broadcast, which was about this impending dull wave and the character called Bureaucrat, who was threatening to overwhelm the country with dullness and make us all conform. He was obsessed with checking best before dates and making sure people's shoelaces were tied. So we did this call out saying that we needed the energy and creativity of children to come and create their own identities and come and save the world from the dull wave. You'll be pleased to know that they were successful. We use narrative within lots of our events so that children have a way of buying in. There's often an underpinning ethic. For example, we did a big event in 2014 called We Forgot the Lot, which was a collaboration with Tate Schools and Teachers team at Tate Britain. It was a national event, and we worked with 11 artists who created activities and installations and things that the children could engage with, based on the idea of changing your environment to meet your individual requirements. So the idea of changing space to meet your needs was the underpinning theme of the event. This wasn't spelled out to the children, but there was this narrative of Tate needs. Tate has revamped all of its gallery spaces, but it's forgotten how people would look at art and how people would move in galleries. So we need you to come and help us. We invent the way we look at art, so it was get involved with the artist and make sure that nothing gets forgotten. So increasingly, I suppose, the way that performance crept into our practice was through the role of narrative in communicating ideas, in getting children excited and feel like they have power within the particular space. Understandings. I think when we started Tourette's Hero, we had no idea how other people with Tourette's would respond, but we've had incredible support. There's been very little difficulty and misunderstanding of our position. I think that that is because of where the laughter sits, and how careful we are about how we then communicate that externally. That doesn't always work. We talk a lot to journalists about language, and you get brilliant articles with the headlines written by someone else. It can then be pretty bleak. But the thing about lots of stuff being online now is that you can sometimes get them to change where it expressly goes against something that we've been specific about. One of the great things about Tourette's Hero being an organisation, rather than me as an individual artist, and being part of a team, is that some of that work, some of the real emotional labour of that, can be held and taken on by people who care about it and understand it on a really deep level. It doesn't have to be me all the time, which is what's made the way that Tourette's Hero works sustainable. And it's very much an equal collaborative project. Matthew's contribution is often not understood as easily, because he's not a public face in the same way. But it is, there's definitely this synergy between our individual practices. That means that together I feel that we can both be better artists, if that makes sense. Unrelaxed performance. I had this difficult experience at the Tricycle Theatre, where despite having done loads of prep beforehand, and Mark Thomas introducing me to the audience at the start of the show, I was still asked to move at the interval and sit in the sound booth, because people were threatening to not come back unless I left or was moved. And it was obvious that Mark wasn't comfortable with that happening at the time. And by the time that had been asked of me, I felt I had no choice but to move. And it was a deeply humiliating and upsetting experience. And I sat and watched the rest of the show in floods of tears in this sound booth behind glass. Backstage in Biscuitland. We basically did the big project with Tate in March or April 2014. And then immediately afterwards, the weekend afterwards, we launched the Kickstarter for Welcome, Backstage in Biscuitland, which was made with Jess Mabel Jones. Me and Matthew co-devised it, and we also got funding, a research and development award from Unlimited. I think our background in play meant that we, and our lack of knowledge of how you made theatre, and of more formal arts funding, meant that we made the whole show. We missed out the research and development bit, made the show and took it to Edinburgh, made a finished thing on $5,000. We were then supported to develop it more and be able to tour it, which was phenomenal. I saw more theatre in my first week at Edinburgh than I'd seen in my life to that point. We knew in making Biscuitland that we wanted to take a show that talked about Tourette's, my experience more broadly, but also particularly talked about theatre and our belief that making art inclusive makes it better, makes it stronger, richer, deeper art, and makes the experience of it more interesting for everyone. I think within Tourette's Hero, the idea of art as a catalyst for change, and the idea that you can use creativity to present stuff in a way that then changes people's thinking, was something that we very much believed in. Backstage in Biscuitland is a really great example of what that means in practice, and how wide that reach can be in terms of drawing people's attention to those barriers and people wanting to make work, other artists making work in different ways. All of the performances were relaxed, which meant that wherever we toured, we would do a load of work with those venues about what that meant. Matthew will often describe our work as a Trojan horse, and I think that's quite a good way of thinking about it. What I do. There's so many people assume I can't work or don't work, and I liked having a job that was a project management job that didn't straightforwardly relate to my impairment, that challenged those assumptions really easily. It took me a long time after leaving Oasis to really be able to confidently answer the question, what do you do? I didn't know what to say. Do I say in terms of Tourette's Hero? I worried about what that meant for my identity, particularly something that related so closely to my impairment. But I also realised that loads of that was about my concerns about other people's perceptions rather than what I was actually doing as a job. I think that was identifying as a sort of politically disabled person, it's interesting how sometimes other people's language and ideas can really easily be internalised and get into your thinking. It takes a lot of energy and attention sometimes to unpick that and work out, I feel this way. Not because that's inherent in what I feel, but because I've got all these concerns that relate to other people and not to me. It's hard sometimes to separate the rubbish from the real feelings or perspective. Broadcast in Biscuitland. In 2015, we made Broadcast in Biscuitland, which was live from Television Centre, which went out on BBC Four. And to go from being asked to leave a theatre to being live on TV with a choir of people in cat T-shirts, giant inflatable cats and dogs and biscuits. I mean, that was a really just mind-blowing moment for me. And just before, just as Kirsty Walk introduced us, and just before we went live, I led the audience in a chorus of, "Don't fuck it up, fuck it up, fuck it up, don't fuck it up." And then we did it. Brewing in Battersea. We held an event at Battersea Arts Centre called Brewing in Battersea, the last few days of the summer holiday. We did daytime activities for children and young people, then cabaret on one of the evenings celebrating disability culture, with an older young people and adult audience. I was watching children come into the beautiful auditorium, the beautiful dome at Battersea. I don't know quite what you'd call it, but there's an amazing stained glass dome with light coming through. And we'd created this amazing, my designer had created this amazing installation full of potions and mixtures in the middle, and it was covered in fragile stickers. But then there were play workers encouraging children to touch it and get involved and move the liquid away. And I watched children, families come into that space, and I was very aware that there were children coming into that space who in every other environment in their lives, I could instantly see from how their behaviour and character and energy was presenting itself, that it's like you're going to be made to feel like a problem in lots of different areas of your life. There's very few places where you will be accepted in this amazing way that you are, with this amazing imagination and sort of force behind your being. And I felt really proud to be part of creating spaces where people, and specifically children, get to be themselves exactly as they are. But the flip side of that then feels very sad. I was very aware that the majority of these children's experiences would not be like that. And it was so simple to create that. I loved the mix of a very intricate, fragile-looking sculpture with their absolute permission to reshape it. I did feel really connected at that point to those young people in relation to my own experience. But also in thinking about how we create a future where different minds and bodies are considered and more people are going to feel free and safe to be themselves exactly as they are. Because what that then added to that event, in terms of the amazing directions, playful directions that we went in because those children were in the room and that they didn't work, their brains don't work in conventional normative ways, it just made for humour and joy and creative roots that I don't think anybody would have got to otherwise. Not I. Matthew had introduced me to Not I years before Tourette's Hero, when my tics had first been intensifying, and so it had been a reference for us for a while. And it came up within a discussion with another theatre company, who were asking me to get involved with a project that they were doing, which was around a classic text. Within that conversation, we mentioned Not I, and someone around the table said, oh, you'd never get, the Beckett estate would never let Jess perform that. And I think that was the point that my fate was sealed. Because Matthew came out of that meeting and was like, so, Not I, I wonder how that works with the Equality Act. He became fascinated by that side of things, and as to whether we would get, who gets a say in performance work, and in what roles. And for a long time we thought, well, if they don't let us perform that, I would make a show that would put a question mark on the end and be, why not I? But the more I read it and the more I looked at it, the more interested we became in demonstrating, modelling how you would make a really intense piece of theatre accessible at every level without reducing its intensity, and to really challenge the cultural curation that was happening around relaxed performance. The idea that relaxed performance, it was all right for The Lion King to be relaxed, but nobody would do a Beckett play as a relaxed performance. So it's like, all right, we'll do that. And actually, the Beckett estate were very supportive of us. Talking to Edward Beckett. We were very careful in how we made the approach. We were lucky in being really well supported by the Beckett community. The academic and scholar community around Beckett's work were incredibly supportive of us. And we did a lot of talking and thinking about the approach to Edward Beckett and the Beckett estate. I wrote an email. It was a very simple response. He said his sole interest was in Samuel Beckett's work being performed as it was intended. If we felt we could honour that, then he was happy for us to proceed. And then we met him personally, had more detailed discussions. One of the interesting things was that actually it was not the text being performed by someone with Tourette's that needed the most discussion. It was the integration of the British Sign Language. Because I just don't think that they had been asked that before. I think we felt a real responsibility, because it's like if we get this wrong, then that could potentially be a barrier, a more fixed barrier for loads of people in the future. If we get it right, it's potentially opening that up. But we very clearly identified Mouth as a disabled character, a neurodiverse character, and felt that it was right that she was performed by someone, by a performer who identified in that way. Creating the performance. Beckett's famous quote was, "For God's sake, don't act," which was a relief because I can't act. One of the things that makes me laugh when people call me an actor is that actually Tourette's makes me really rubbish at acting because I'm very bad at pretending. I will call it out straight away. But it's working with those. That's how Tourette's becomes our collaborator. Because it's those creative constraints that I think become really interesting. And that's definitely what we had with Not I. Previously, in other productions, how it had been presented historically became the guide, rather than Samuel Beckett's initial directions. So we went back to those and we thought, how are we going to make this work for my body? And I liked that because that also fits with the social model idea that it's not right to expect us all to do things in the same way, because that's going to mean that some people don't achieve stuff, not because they can't, but because they need to do it in a different way. There's an element where it's very hard, I think, now. Well, I hope it's very hard for a performer or director to turn round to me and say it's all very well doing relaxed performances for light comedy shows, but you could never do it for serious work. I performed that monologue while 6 or 7 other people shout very, very brilliant things in the air, and it has made me concentrate harder. It's meant my performance was better. All the things that I said, it was like, oh, that's actually true. I do believe that, particularly within theatre, that live environment, the great thing about relaxed performance is that it really makes theatre live, or can do. It's then supporting people to feel confident. Making it relaxed. Working with Battersea Arts Centre in a really collaborative way, we wanted to develop a methodology that flips that assumption. Rather than it being a case where you have performances that have the traditional rules and expectations, sort of uptight, very normative idea of a singular normative body who is the audience member, and with occasional relaxed or accessible performances, we just wanted to flip that assumption. What happens if you say that all our performances, all of our programme takes a relaxed approach and will meet the 7 core elements of a relaxed performance? Unless there is a clear creative rationale, why not? That's sort of a simple flip with a more complicated lot of chatting and learning and adjusting that needs to happen underneath, underpinning it. The hope is that that is a methodology that is flexible enough to go across different organisations, not just theatre, but also usable within a museum or gallery context, and that it's also designed to be able to be stepped through by really small organisations with no resources, or bigger organisations with a load of resources, because some of the principles remain the same. What you can invest in it obviously makes a difference in terms of the impact. But I think that there are some small steps that cultural institutions could make that would make a radical difference in terms of access. And what's frustrating is that often it doesn't feel like there is that willingness to change. I just feel a bit fed up with excuses, because actually it isn't that hard, and the knowledge isn't that difficult to find. Working conditions. Why do we go to theatre and expect not to sit next to a learning disabled person? Why are people with conditions like Tourette's having to make shows to occupy space, or to have to actively advocate for their inclusion in these spaces? One of the things that frustrates me is that companies say that not all directors are into doing relaxed performance. Well, you get to make the work you do, but you don't get to say who gets to see it. If you're not prepared to do relaxed performance, then list who you don't want in your audience. Tell me who you don't want. I think that that is the difficult thing about the exclusion of disabled people. Because there's this perception that for so long the idea was that you gave access as a charitable act, as a gift. It was a nice bonus that you did for people, rather than the right of everybody to be able to access our shared cultural space. We're chipping away at that, but it definitely hasn't been smashed to pieces yet. And finally, hedgehog, sausage, bucket. I love dogs. I love Teletubby tits, biscuit. This is a poem about bears. The bears fucked an octopus. The octopus had gloves on, biscuit. Nobody smells of wee, but everyone smells of smiles. Fuck a goat. I love pita bread. I actually quite like pita bread, don't like cats. I don't mind cats. Fuck the cat. solidly indifferent to cats. Sausage.